Welcome, everybody, to the Aaron's High Cap Adventure Radio Program. Matt, your host here. We're doing the Facebook Live episode with Dr. Shelley Cole, HealthySuccessWorks.com. You know, Shelley, it's amazing for a guy like me who went to college and didn't really go to class but did the other parts of college.
Really?
Brain cells left to remember all this stuff. Okay. Anyway, we do our normal show Saturday from 9 to noon. And Dr. Shelley comes on every third Saturday of the month. You can check her out at KMIL 105.1 FM The Ranch, also at KRXT 98.5 FM out of Rockdale. You can check us out live here on Facebook, yada, yada, yada.
Well, and then we do have the podcast. Well, Apple Podcast.
Spotify, Podbean. Thank you very much. We've got thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of downloads. So check it out. Shelley, we've been talking, and we've got a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. There really is.
Why don't you open up the book and let the people see the contents of what we're going to be doing today?
Well, and we got a lot going on. So I want to cover some like articles, some of the local news, and some of the current news that's out there. I want to cover what's going on, and then we may take a few steps back and go into the pandemic. I want to talk about a tale of two diseases.
Sorry.
A tale of two diseases. And I kind of think, not that I ever have wanted to make Matt mad, but...
You're not going to make me mad.
Yeah.
I want the truth. Good. I want the truth.
Yeah, yes. Well, unfortunately, the truth hurts sometimes, you know. Jeez. So I know that Matt has, had a position for many, many years, and so did I. I mean, I was a physician and certainly believed in vaccinating my kids.
And I will explain my position once you... I'm going to explain my position as to why I believe I did, where I did, and...
We'll take it from there.
Yeah.
So, and then we have a very special guest. I'm really excited. We have Aslan Murphy, and she is here with me this week in my office. And she is a very courageous young woman, and I want you all to hear her story, so I'm excited about that.
And I think what we'll do is I'll get out of the camera view, and we'll bring Aslan onto the camera.
She's okay. Sounds good.
All right, Shelley.
What's news?
I saw this. It's amazing. You see certain things, you think of certain things. I see articles, I think of Dr. Shelley. Okay.
Oh, that's good.
Virologists warn imminent new COVID crisis among vaccinated will cause chaos and collapse society. So the first thing I did was read the article and go, Shelley, is this guy legit? Does he know what he's doing? Blah, 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 blah. So let's hit that first. And this,
What does he say? So what's going to collapse everything?
Here's a quote. What we will be facing in the hyperacute COVID crisis that is imminent is that we'll have to build a completely new world, says Dr. Gert van den Bosch. It is very, very clear that when this starts, our hospitals will collapse, and that means all chaos in all kinds of layers of society, financial, economic, social, you name it, will be complete. And this is a world-renowned Belgian virologist, Gert van den Bosch, as he issued a grave warning of an imminent massive tsunami of COVID illnesses and deaths among the vaccinated that will collapse hospitals and cause financial, economic, and social chaos. First of all, if you're a doctor with this long resume, if I was this doctor, the last thing I would do is say this and jeopardize everything I've built my career on. Would that be
very true. I mean, he has a PhD in virology.
So he must be very confident in what he's saying. So that's why I asked, Do you know this guy? Can you give us any insight?
Yes, I do remember he really became famous right around the time that the vaccinations were released in December of 2020 and then January 2021. And so one of his principles were very important. We're going to learn a little bit about immunology now, because the vaccine works on kind of our second defenses. What our body has is our first line defenses, what we call the innate immune system, will fight anything that it comes up against. It doesn't matter. It doesn't go, well, this is a very particular virus and I'm going to attack it. It just will try to kill anything it can. Okay?
Deflect their shields are on.
That's right. It's her first line defense. And that's the innate immune system. Okay? And it doesn't have the memory, though. The more we learn, because I still think we only know this much about the human body, the more we learn, even the innate immune system has some memory, recollection, which is fascinating to read even more about it. But it's the frontline defenses, okay?
Let me add on another paragraph to what he says. This is coming from Belgian virologist Gert van den Bosch.
Also, I think you like saying his name.
No, I don't, actually. You will see what will happen, for example, in the next coming weeks, is more and more cases of more serious long COVID. And you talk long.
Right.
They will start to replace the surge of the cancers. Now we have more of a chronic phase. It will end up with hyperacute phase, a huge, huge wave. I've been studying this now for 4 years. I know what I'm talking about. I'm probably the only person, in all modesty, who understands the immunological... Hello?
Immunology.
Thank you. 25-cent guy here behind this, Bosch said.
So what he's talking about is that the COVID vaccine had a lot of consequences that we really haven't seen yet. And so I remember learning about how the vaccine worked. And you have to realize it's a completely different technology than old vaccines. And what it does is, we know that in the past, the manufacturer, pharma, Merck Pharmaceutical or Pfizer, would give us a little snippet of a bug, and then we would make these antibodies, which is our second line of defenses, okay? And so what the mRNA vaccine also had in it, in addition to about 80 billion spike proteins that were naked and just kind of tumbling around, wreaking havoc, the other component was the mRNA aspect of it, where it actually gave us the machinery to make more of the spike proteins, okay? And my rudimentary understanding of virology was like, okay, so if the body's going to start making these spike proteins, how in the heck is it going to know if it's foreign or self, if it's self or non-self? Yeah. Because now it's making it.
That's right.
Okay.
We've been talking about that for years now.
Right. And that was what was so terrifying to me. And so what we're talking about is autoimmune disease, right? The body starts attacking itself. We don't know why the body starts. Well, we know that it would attack the spike protein, but our bodies made the spike protein. So I knew that there was going to be significant issues with regards to autoimmunity, you know, when the vaccine.
So being the type of doctor that you are, I'm totally ignorant of what I'm about to say, but I've heard this, and I'm just using it as a parallel for a better understanding. Like, when a woman's pregnant as a baby, doesn't the body want to just throw out this thing? There's got to be something in there that keeps it from doing it?
Yes. And it is the most amazing ability for the body to have a robust, healthy immune system, but you have foreign DNA matter in your uterus, right?
So the human body understands, we don't want to mess with this one, but the spike protein is going like, I don't know what to do.
Right. And the spike protein doesn't have that kind of sophistication.
For a 25-cent guy, I kind of have a handle on things. Okay.
Well, you do, but I will tell you that during pregnancy, oftentimes women will have a lot of decay in the mouth because their immune system isn't as strong as it used to be. So during the pregnancy particularly.
That is a great segue to finish up this particular article, because let me say this once again. Belgian virologist Gert
van den Bosch,
he says this. He went on to advise vaccinated individuals that the best way to protect their delicate immune systems is to avoid contracting COVID again. Quote, what I can advise to all these vaccinated people, they need to avoid reinfection. It is the reinfection of vaccinated people that is responsible for the situation. Well, the only thing they can do is very simply is take antivirals, of course.
Right. Okay. The vaccines caused something that Van den Bosch talked a lot about in 2021 and what this article really kind of represents. And what happened was, when we decided that we were going to vaccinate people during a pandemic, okay, not after the pandemic, this is the first time it's ever happened, okay? When we decided that we were going to vaccinate people during the pandemic, we pushed the virus to mutate. Okay, we made it change, we made it altered so rapidly, and if you looked at the number of variants back in 2021, I mean, it was an exponential rise of variants. Do you remember that?
I remember it all. The details I have to look back up again.
But thousands of variants, because the vaccine pushed and forced the virus to mutate, okay? Instead of allowing natural immunity to help us and the normal natural forces with slow alterations in the virus and fewer mutations, this virus mutated into oblivion, okay? So that we had all of these different viral strains. And so if we, like in the past, when we would have a disease, if you got the disease, you got the immunity. So now you have that humoral immunity, that antibody to the virus. You didn't get it again. But this one, we saw people coming back 2 and 3 times. And it was a struggle because, you know, it was like, well, this is not normal. You know, you're supposed to have immunity, and yet now you're getting some weird variant. But because it had mutated so significantly from the original, that, they had symptoms again. So they became symptomatic.
Shelby, we've got Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson putting out these shots, right? We've had complications. Is this next article not a validation that there's something wrong with the shot? Moderna developing mRNA vaccines for diseases linked to the COVID shots. So they're like, I've always said Star Trek has an answer to every situation. Right? Well, the movie Star Trek, Kirk has to get on the ship, and so Dr. McCoy makes him sick. Well, the side effects is he starts getting fat hands, hairy tongue, and all this kind of stuff. He says, it's okay, I got a shot for that. He says, get away from me. So here we have Moderna developing it. They made tons of money selling the crap, and now they're making tons of money to maybe fix the crap.
They never even had an FDA-approved drug before the COVID vaccine. And, you know, they got the EUA for this, and it's appalling. So what does it say? It says that more diseases.
I'll bounce through it. As Moderna expands its mRNA vaccine pipeline to target Epstein-Barr shingles, cancer, and autoimmune diseases, scientists warns the company's COVID-19 shots may be suppressing immune function.
Right.
Reactivating latent viruses and potentially causing the very conditions their new product aims
to
prevent.
Right. So,
Moderna says they also question whether Moderna is attempting to profit from the solutions for diseases.
Imagine that. Never. Yes. So, when we were talking about how the vaccine works, one of the main principles is whenever you, and you have to realize we have limited resources. The body's resources are not just infinite, okay? So, if we're going to be making a whole lot of antibodies to try to fight this virus off and the spike protein, then we're going to take away from our resources for our frontline defenders, our first line.
Makes sense to
me. Our innate, okay? Uh-huh. And so that is just the way the body works. It's called a negative feedback mechanism. So if you're making more antibodies to a specific virus, or a snippet of a specific virus, then you are going to make less of the natural defenses to fight off everything else.
Which then it snowballs.
That's right. That's right. And so I think that's what Gert Van Den Bosch...
Now, if you're going to say it right. Gert Van Den Bosch.
Okay. The Belgian virologist who became famous.
From now on, it will be the Belgian virologist. The
Belgian virologist, Gert Van Den Bosch.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, the consequences we have seen since then, and so is he saying that COVID long haulers, I guess the opposition to Dr. Van Den Bosch is that it's the COVID long haulers that are causing all the problems?
No, it didn't say it in this one. The doctor was saying that.
Okay.
About the long haulers.
Right.
There's long COVID, a more serious long COVID.
Right. So that they do have, they're more ill. They're more likely to get more infections because, again, their frontline defenses are less.
You know, I've had it for a while.
Yeah.
I didn't take a shot. So what does that mean?
So you were exposed to significant mutants, you know, along the way. You've been taking ivermectin, right? Mm-hmm. You still take ivermectin. The problem is, we don't know if this is COVID or if it's the flu or if it's any other virus that we usually suffer with.
I'll tell you though, my breathing is, I haven't had a problem breathing anymore.
Well, that's good.
Except for this allergy thing I got.
That's really, really good.
Because there'd be times when I'd wake up gasping for air. I'm just like, this is crazy.
Well, you're welcome to use our red light therapy. It really works on respiratory infections.
Okay. Anything else you want to hit those two? Because I've got one more article, and we've got some time in this segment.
No, you can go ahead and just read what's the next article.
This is related to the COVID.
Okay.
Heart scarring, and we've heard about this a lot, in worms, and detected more than a year after COVID-19 vaccination in some patients. This is the
myocarditis.
Yes, that one. When some people started experiencing...
Can I give you a tip?
Yes.
Matt, any time the word ends in itis, that means inflammation.
Inflammation.
Okay.
Tonsillitis.
That's right.
Or heart inflammation after receiving COVID-19 vaccines, public health authorities and the media downplayed the severity of the problem and insisted that the protection offered by the vaccines was worth the risk.
Wow.
However, it is not now emerging that the problem is more serious than the vaccine supporters initially claimed. So Trump said that a long time ago. He says, the solution can't be worse than the problem. And so this vaccine, the sickness that you could have done in most cases and just run it out like the flu, you didn't need the shot, is causing more problems after you get the shot.
So before the vaccine, you remember what the survivability was. We said it 100 times on the radio.
95%.
No. It was 99.997.
All right. Well, I was off. 4%.
You were talking about what Pfizer said was the effectiveness of the COVID vaccine.
Well, that's right. Yes. What she said.
Right. Right. But what I'm saying is the survival. If you got COVID before the vaccine was available, the survival of all comers, all age groups... 99.997.
Do you understand that? I mean, it's 25% as I understand that. That means out of everybody, 99% of them are going to be fine. They're going to be fine.
Now,
right?
Please let me make a correction. I think it was 97% for all comers, 99.97 for anyone under the age of 25. I'm glad I got to correct it. Yeah. So it was incredibly high. And you remember that Stanford study that came out early in the pandemic that really showed that most people, 50 to 80% of people, were asymptomatic completely. So they didn't even have any symptoms, so we didn't even know. So they were actually allowing natural herd immunity. People didn't even have symptoms, and they were going and helping protect and fight the transmission of the virus to the rest of the community.
Now, Shelley, as smart as you are, and as experienced as you are.
Okay. You know, you're putting a lot of pressure on me now. Because
I said, and with all this information, I'm saying this because of our conversation on this show last Saturday. I personally believe if they try to pull this crap again, at least a third of the people are going to follow. And I think a little bit more than that, when they say it's not worth the trouble, I'll comply. What do you think?
I think you're probably right.
What's today's date?
I think you're probably right.
You see, that amount of people, and with a bought and paid media, and with a corrupt and sordid agenda of the left, that's going to be enough to make it chaotic in this country again, around the planet too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we have a third of people deciding to take... Moderna is going to be creating vaccines for what? All of these new ones. So, Epstein-Barr, varicella zoster. So they're going to be making mRNA vaccines. And so they're going to give the machinery to make the antigen itself. So it's just going to be autoimmune disease on fire.
How do we fight this?
Well, we have to say no. I mean, absolutely not. I think most Americans, and would you say, so 67%, at least people are going to say, I am not willing to, I don't trust the CDC anymore, because we know that they do profit off of vaccines. I don't trust the FDA anymore. The NIH, who should be doing studies on repurposed drugs during the pandemic instead of vaccinating people and causing the virus to spiral out of control, they should be doing studies on repurposed drugs like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. But they didn't. And so this last week, was it last week? I think it was last week or the week before, you know, ivermectin was vindicated.
Yes.
So the FDA had to withdraw all of its inflammatory tweets that it made about, you know, horse dewormer, and come on, y'all, you know, stop using ivermectin.
Can you reflect back on your life and say to yourself, I've counted on certain people, come to find out, they won't hold up to the end of the bargain. So when we have 100%, and I say 30% are going to do it, 70% believe exactly what we believe.
Yeah.
However, you can add another, in my opinion, another 20% of those who I don't want to cause a problem. I don't want to make a wave. It's good. There's no... I don't know. There might be a resurgence of common sense, but I just see these guys doing it all over again. And you know what's funny? I keep reading more and more and more as the closer and closer we get to November.
Sure.
Don't call
of course.
Me crazy,
but... Of course. No, you're not crazy. I mean, I think most people are kind of trusting what you're believing. I mean, my belief in life is, and it's my philosophy, and I think it's even on my Facebook page, which I can't get into because I've been locked out since 2021. But the myocarditis that you were talking about, that's what literally locked me out of Facebook. So I published a PowerPoint slide from the CDC, the ACIP meeting, which was really to approve the vaccinations. And so what they did was they broke down the risk for myocarditis, so inflammation of the heart, and it was significantly higher for young people, particularly young boys, but it was bad overall.
Instead of saying it was bad for this percentage of people, wouldn't it be better to say, from this point, here's the dividing line between, we haven't seen this, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, people are dropping dead.
Right.
Heart problems, heart worms, heart scarring, right after the shot. Wouldn't that be a better illustration to say, hey, something's up. You give them the shots, and from the shots on, this is what happens. Because before the shots, you never heard of this stuff. It existed. I'm not denying it existed. But you didn't hear it to this explosion.
Well, remember, that's when they came up with SAD, you know, the sudden adult onset disease, you know, so they know this narrative. they've done this before, and that's what I want to cover later on today, is the tale of two diseases. You know, but all EOEs is for good men to do nothing. That is my philosophy.
Who said it? No.
Edwin Burke. It's Thomas my Jefferson. Paraphrase. Thomas Jefferson said it too. Well, it's my Shelley derivation, because okay. I had to put it on the slide, a poster one time, and so I had to fit it all in. But that's my derivation of it. But so instead of passively following the crowd on this next time, because there's going to be a crisis, we know that. I don't know if it's Dr. Gert Van den Bosch, everything's going to collapse. But I do know that they're going to try to create a crisis.
We're almost going to go to break here. So we go all the way back to this first article, and you say you don't know if it's going to be a crash. That's why I asked you if this guy had any validity. Because he's staking his reputation.
Yes, he is. He is. And he's been studying it, and he painstakingly looked at all of it. I just look at the overall picture of it and see this has devastating consequences to our natural immune system. And there are two jobs for the immune system. One is to fight infection, and don't be scared of infections. We're exposed to thousands and thousands of bacteria and viruses. 90% of the DNA on our body is not our own. I mean, we're exposed to this all the time. If you're scared of infections, then you're going to be living in fear all your life. What you want to do is say, how do I help those first line innate immune responses and fight them? Not do all these vaccinations that cause a negative feedback mechanism and lower the body's ability to fight generalized infection. Who wants to be making antibodies to a virus that mutated a long time ago, and now we're making antibodies to something that was present in December of 2019?
Yeah, what she said. Shelly, yeah. What do you know about dogs' mouths?
Is this a segue to the next half hour?
It's a stereotypical thing, like dogs have clean mouths.
Right.
Because you were just saying we have a tremendous high percentage of DNA from other sources.
Yeah.
So when my dog licks me and kisses me, I'm okay, right?
You are definitely okay.
All right, why don't you give us a teaser as to what's coming up in the
next episode? I want to cover... we're going to have Aslan Murphy in a little while, but I want to cover something beforehand, because we've talked about the polio virus before, and of course everyone gets terrified and thinks of, the iron lung machines and so forth. And so we're going to go back in history. We're going to do a tale of two diseases, and I'm really excited to cover this. I have to tell you, I don't like doing all of these things, and but because I feel that this is my job, this is at least one thing that I can do to contribute to the foundation of truth so that people will stand up. I don't feel comfortable. I'd much rather be seeing patients than do this right now.
Yeah, she's stepping up to the plate, ladies and gentlemen. So get your popcorn, your glasses of coffee or whatever it is, and we're going to take a
summer moon
3 or 4 minute break. The camera will be on, it'll be live, but the mic will be muted, so we'll be back in a few minutes, okay?
Thanks, man.
Alright, everybody, welcome back. Matt and Dr. Shelley Cole, HealthySuccessWorks.com, the Aaron's High Cap Adventure Radio Program, Facebook Live edition of the show. Don't forget, every Saturday from 9 to noon on KMIL, 105.1 FM, The Ranch, also KRXT 98.5 FM, and you can also check it out, all programming is put in the podcast form, and we have thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of downloads, and you can check it out on Apple, Spotify, Podbean, or just go to aaronsgunshop.com, go to the radio show page, and bam, there it is.
Yeah, so we did talk about magnesium a lot on Saturday on the podcast, where we could probably eliminate at least one or two different subspecialty fields of medicine if people just took magnesium. Like, I don't think the cardiologists would probably have too many.
And you said the only really big problem with overdosing on magnesium is having a
stomach.
Diarrhea.
Yeah, you all know milk of magnesia.
So we had some callers call in about that. I think the actual caller called in about milk of magnesia.
Right, exactly. Okay, so a little disclaimer, because it's a perfect point. I am not an expert on polio, okay? I just started to read about it, but this is so fascinating, this history of the polio disease and how our country approached it. And so I want to tell, you know, I want you to be COVID, the COVID pandemic, and I'm going to tell you the story of the polio vaccine. Okay. And then I want you to see if you can see any kind of similarities between how they approached polio and how we approached the COVID pandemic.
All right.
Okay.
Mr. COVID is ready.
Okay. Awesome. So poliomyelitis is really just a description of disease of the spine. It can be also of the brain, brain stem. It's just inflammation. Poliomyelitis. ITIS. Okay. And so really, the virus that causes the symptoms of poliomyelitis is only a fraction of the disease. The disease can be caused by chemicals. It can be caused by other viruses. In fact, the Coxsackie virus, there was a study done, and they found that it caused more polio symptoms than polio did.
Should I pull up this article here?
Which one?
You said, Mr. COVID, I'm putting the similarities to it. They're going to make Moderna developing another vaccine to take care of the problem the first time.
Exactly. So before the polio vaccine came out in 1955, the Salk Institute, polio as a disease was very nonspecific. Okay? It could be anything. I mean, it was, I'll just give you a list of them. It could be congenital syphilis, the symptoms. It could be arsenic poisoning. It could be DDT poisoning.
So wait, for clarification, when I'm watching TV and listening to these commercials saying, do you have this,
yeah,
and this? And I go,
yes,
and then you see the next commercial for a totally different product. Says, do you have this? Then I said, well, that was just over here. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
So what I'm trying to say is before the vaccine came out, there were a lot of diseases that had exactly the same symptoms as polio. Okay?
Okay, that's what I just said. All right.
So they were like arsenic poisoning, Guillain-Barre's disease, hand-foot disease, lead poisoning. Okay, all of these things had very similar, and they had the paralysis, and they had, it was very rare. In fact, the CDC itself said that only 1% of people with polio had symptomatology. Let me see, I want to make sure. This is where I'm out of my realm, because I'm not the expert on it, but let me see. It was like the CDC said less than 1% has permanent paralysis from polio. Less than 1%. Now, was that the perception before 1955? Well, we weren't here, so we don't know. But I will tell you that they were terrifying. Okay? All of the diseases were very, very vague. It was very nonspecific, but they all had symptoms like polio. And so...
Who was terrified?
The public.
The public. Okay.
The public was. Because they had these big pictures of people, you know, having the iron lung. And so they thought, well, anyone who gets polio is going to have respiratory paralysis and they're going to be on an iron lung for the rest of their lives and it's over. I mean, that was pretty much the... And they would have pictures of the iron lung, you know, and they'd have pictures, just terrifying pictures. So they didn't have any specific test to check for polio, but they had these soft criteria. Now, I should lift a little flag and say, ding, 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 you need to be thinking, Mr. COVID.
Okay.
Because they had really no definitive test that they used to say this is the polio vaccine, the polio virus that's causing this paralysis, okay? It was a very big bucket of diseases, and they all had similar symptoms. And so what they said was, okay, if you have any of these symptoms, you have polio, and it has to occur over a 48-hour period of time, and we don't have to do any testing. Okay?
Mr. COVID sounds familiar.
Yeah, so the remember when they changed the death certificate?
Yep.
When the COVID pandemic occurred, and they said instead of the cause of disease being, you know, congestive heart failure or, you know, pulmonary, you know, pneumonia, now you can list COVID, and if you list COVID, it will be considered the cause of disease, so that the hospitals can get reimbursed at a higher rate.
And just to back this up, we said it a million times, I've read articles stating where somebody gets in a motorcycle crash and died of COVID because they had COVID.
Right.
It wasn't the concrete wall that he hit. And the other person who got shot and killed by lead projectiles, they had COVID, so they died of COVID. That's baloney. They're just marking up the numbers.
Right. You died with COVID. You didn't die because of COVID. And so they didn't really have any specific diagnostic measure, and it was a whole bunch of various conditions that had similar symptoms, okay? So fast forward to COVID, the PCR test, remember, that overdiagnosed people, because you could have two dead COVID viruses in your nostrils and be diagnosed positive. And they purposely increased the cycle threshold so that it would be less accurate and it would yield a higher number. And so they distorted, before vaccine, they distorted the disease itself. And so remember, we now don't even really know how many people died of heart disease, how many people had cancer, how many people had motor vehicle accidents. We don't know, because if they had a COVID test, which I assure you they probably did, if they went into the hospital during this time and it was positive, the death was allocated to COVID. Okay? So the vaccine comes out in 1955. Okay? And they completely change direction. Now they want to hone in and say, we want to only define polio as having the polio virus. So now they start becoming very specific with their diseases, like Guillain-Barré, like arsenic poisoning, you know, like DDT toxin. And so they started to delineate and differentiate. And so what do you think happened to the cases of polio after the vaccine came out? It went down. It went way down, way, way down. And so what do you think? They said, see how important this polio vaccine is?
I get it.
Are you mad yet? Oh, well, I know you're not mad at me, but you're just...
No, I'm not mad at you, because what she's talking about is when I'm talking about the polio shot and Jonas Stark, is that his name?
Salk Stark,
okay. What I was getting at was, back then, you didn't make a profit. A doctor didn't make a profit for coming up. It was more of the concern of humanity in itself.
Right.
So this person sees this, comes up with it. It's the manipulative people above him. We say, hey, wait a minute. We can make this work out pretty good. But in general, the concept idea is, which I'm arguing with you about, is a person's genuine interest to help society came up with this, had no profitability in it, and supposedly it worked. But now when you talk about this and they divide it all up into separate things, the number of polio goes down, it makes it look like, oh my gosh, this is great.
So like the vaccine did it. Right.
So let's keep doing this, what we're doing for money.
Exactly, exactly. And before 1954, physicians who reported poliomyelitis, guess what? Their care would be reimbursed. The government would subsidize the care of those patients with poliomyelitis. And so, again, doctors financially incentivized to diagnose poliomyelitis before the vaccine. Okay. How many do you think the cases went up?
No.
The cases did go up. Because the doctors were making money off of...
I'm going backwards on this.
Okay.
They're making money
It's complicated. This is a little bit complicated. I mean, these are pretty smart people that do this.
They're making money because they say, hey, if I keep doing this, I get paid more.
Right, right. So what you were saying that, yeah, individual doctors didn't make money, but pharma did. Pharma was there.
Look, you're a perfect example. You don't have any malicious bone in your body. So if you were able to come up with some vaccine because you knew it worked to do this,
right?
That is your sole purpose. And all of a sudden, the people above go, hey, wait a minute. You know, Shelly, wait a minute. Here's what we're going to do for you, okay? We're going to do this, this, that, the other. Here's some money. Shh, quiet. We'll take care of it. We'll do all the marketing.
We'll do the marketing. and so, you know, okay, this is what they do. They cause fear in the public. They over-diagnose the disease. Then they come up with a solution, which is the vaccine, and then they minimize the disease after the vaccine comes out, saying, hey, see, we did it, we did it. So how did they minimize the disease? Well, guess what? They redefined it. So instead of, you know, you could have paralysis for less than 24 hours and be called polio before 1955. After 1955, it became much more stringent. So you had to have paralysis for more than 60 days to be defined as polio. So they redefined it. They made it more stringent. So what do you think? A lot fewer cases occurred. And what's amazing is that why isn't the journals reporting the transverse myelitis cases, the hundreds of cases that Johns Hopkins has every single year, now that they're taking care of? Okay? Children are on the modern day version of the iron lung. Do they report that? No, they don't report that because they don't call it polio.
Let's change the subject here for 1 second just to show you how it hits every aspect of life. I don't know the specific dates, but Nikola Tesla, okay? He comes up to the ability where he can give all of mankind free electricity. And I think it was Westinghouse, One of the guys, no, it wasn't Westinghouse, but somebody, big time guy, money was backing him up.
Right.
And he finds out Nikola Tesla wants to give it out for free. He goes, no.
Right.
We're going to make money. Right. See what I mean? So he goes back. Generations, hundreds of years of people who have money and power steal and take away the goodness of people so that they can benefit for themselves. And make it look like you're getting it. Same thing with this shot here.
Right. So, you know, big corporations buy out small corporations that have innovative, wonderful ideas and just squash it.
Squash it.
Right? I thought this was a fascinating quote. And this was from 1987, and it was Dr. Lynette from the California Department of Health. And this was talking about polio, and he said, actually, economically, the disease wasn't very important. Secondly, not many cases were seen in this country. There weren't too many people paralyzed from polio in any neighborhood, so it never really made much of an impact. Now, ask a first-year medical student, polio, what's the answer, you know, the answer to the test question. They're going to distort it and make it seem like it was this horrible, horrible disease, and that if you got it, you were going to get iron lung.
Now, you're not opposed to even trying to get the 1% who may have it to get a cure for it, right?
Absolutely. We want to help. We want to help people, of course.
So it's not like we're going to say 99% of the people can overcome this on their own, so screw it, the other 1% are on their own. It's just by doing that, when all you said is they market it and make it sound more scary and use the fear factor.
Of course.
You gotta keep all this information in your head so that when you see something else come up, you can put it through the sniff test.
So they even deleted pictures of the iron lung cases after the vaccination.
Full coverage.
So they distorted it. And so that's when, the March of Dimes became this, we're working together, stronger, healthy babies, vaccinations for infants and pregnant mothers. You know, that's instead of, you know, supporting, you know, the crisis of a disease, now we're here to support, you know, vaccinations for pregnant moms. I mean, it's unbelievable.
So, Shelley, the WHO, World Health Organization, the CDC, all these major establishments, to help and guide humanity into safety is a joke. Is that correct? That's my asking you the question. You can state what you wish.
Well,
I can't trust anything.
I didn't really look at the credentials of Tedros, you know. I think they're highly suspect, but, you know, the whole thing is, you know, when one individual can fund a huge percentage of an organization like that, like the Bill Gates Foundation did, you know, you wonder about it. So one of the other reasons why polio was so overblown back in the 1940s, the way they treated paralysis was they would bind up the legs, they splinted and cast people if they had any kind of paralysis, and they did it for 3 to 6 months, okay? So just think about it. You know, some child gets sick, and so they cast the legs, and so they're inactive for 2 years.
Oh, gosh.
Okay? I mean, it's devastating. So it was really improper treatment of polio at that time in 1940. And so It overblew the fear factor in there. You know, now families are dealing with this. Well, we treated it wrong. Yes, docs, we treated it wrong. And there was this physical therapist. She really wasn't technically a physical therapist, but she's kind of the mother of physical therapy. Her name was Sister Elizabeth Kinney. And she was a pioneer, and she saw this happening. And they were literally cutting tendons. Okay, that's what doctors would do, cut tendons and cast and the paralyzed limbs. And so she came along and she said, let's not do that.
I wouldn't do that.
No. So she came along and she properly treated these people. She gave them massage. She helped the muscles develop and so they healed. They were healed. And so it took 30 years of her life to retrain the world in how to deal with muscular and paralysis. And so she was the one who really did that. You know, so we treated it poorly, and just like we did COVID, right? We decided not to, you know, use repurposed drugs like ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. We treated, you know, with drugs like remdesivir, okay? And we know that was related to deaths. That's why they shortened the use of the drug from 30 days down to 10 days. But nevertheless, we treated it poorly as a profession, and so again, the fear factor. And then if you look at some of the other things that happened, so DDT, do you remember that?
I do. Mosquitoes.
Yeah, and so they would spray it. Oh my gosh, and we would literally run through the fog.
I'll tell you what, if you had to put that on a scale, run through the fog and get the mosquitoes off you.
Right.
You don't have to get bit like crazy. I think I might go that way.
You might go through the DDT. Well, so what they would do is they would spray the beaches, okay? And everyone was coming out to the beaches, and they found that the DDT, and of course they said it's a pesticide and it's safe and effective, right? You know, that's...
Of course.
Oh, and so everyone accepts it. It's like, okay, well, it's been studied.
Because we're
so that means it's safe and effective.
Because we're having faith in government.
Because we had faith in the scientific method, and we had faith that the government, you know, it would...
You know, technically the internet was used for internal government practices.
Right.
Once it got out to the civilian market, everybody at the same time could find out the same information, come up with the same conclusion, it was over. That's what's happened now. Nobody trusts anything because they can see the facts.
Well, that's a whole nother can of worm. I hope that we can get into. I mean, I don't like to get too much into the politics because there's so much corruption in medicine that I need to cover. But yeah, you know, the early days of the internet were a blast. They were a blast because the small guy could come out and present his opinion, and if you could read it, it was logical, it made sense. But ever since, you know, Google is 93% of all searches are done on Google. Yeah, you know,
all of it's almost artificial intelligence.
I think it's 90% of people don't even go to the second page of searches. You know, so I mean, they completely control the narrative. So,
Now look, Shelly, we're at a break time, and I know you're going to be having a special guest on here.
We are.
So,
why don't
you give this little snippet segue before
okay.
we break?
Okay. So I'm going to be introducing just in a couple minutes, we're going to talk to Aslan Murphy, and she is a nurse practitioner student who really has had an awakening during the pandemic. She was in school, and she's gone through, and she is willing to talk to us, and we're very excited. And we'll be talking to her next.
Fantastic. All right, we're going to take a break. See you in about 4 minutes. Welcome back, everybody, to the Aaron's High Cap Adventure Radio Program. Matt, your host here. I've got special guest Dr. Shelly Cole, HealthySuccessWorks.com. She's got a special guest she wants to present to you, so I'm going to roll the camera back over.
So I'm super excited to introduce Aslan Murphy, and she is a nurse practitioner student from Lubbock, Texas. And so her story is unusual because she really sought us out because she wanted to see a different way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And so, Aslan, tell us a little bit about why you went into nursing to begin with.
Mm. So I have always wanted to be a nurse. Just since I was little, I wanted to care for people, be with them in their darkest times. I really see nursing as an extension of Christ and what He wants to do for His people in caring for them and holding them close when times are dark and scary and painful. Yeah. So I've always wanted to be a nurse. There was never a time I wanted to be anything else.
Well, that's awesome. That's so awesome. I mean, just a generous, kind, giving heart, you know, to want to serve people. That's pretty amazing. Do you come from a family of nurses or anyone in your family nurses?
My grandmother was a nurse. Okay. So I grew up seeing her just like plaques on the wall and little figurines of nurses.
Right.
And, she was on the Louisiana Board of Nursing. She was the president.
Wow.
A period of time, and so she's very proud of nursing. But then my immediate family, I'm really the only medical person in my immediate family. But yes, my grandmother was a big influence.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, did you go to public school, or were you homeschooled, or what?
So I was homeschooled all the way until 8th grade.
Okay.
And then 8th grade I went to a private Christian school in Lubbock. And so I got very personalized private education through that, which I'm very thankful for.
Absolutely. It's interesting. In my journey during the pandemic, I always have been curious about young people that are, their eyes are open. Mm-hmm. And so typically I hear that it's the homeschooled, more of an independent thinker, mm-hmm. That's able to wake up earlier.
Yes.
and go, wait a minute. An independent thinker who's allowed to develop their own opinion about something.
Yes.
So I think that was foundational in your life.
Yes.
So tell me, did you get vaccinated?
I COVID vaccinated or any vaccine?
Any.
I got a few. I'm very thankful for my parents because they taught me a healthy skepticism of medicine.
Yes.
Capital M medicine, and then a healthy skepticism of the government.
Right.
I was very patriotic, but also not just completely trusting.
That's interesting, Aslan, because you wanted to be a nurse, but you had some skepticism.
Yes.
About medicine. So
yes.
How did you reconcile that?
Well, before COVID, before becoming a nurse, I believed that I could do both. I believed that I could be more interested in homeopathic or all the different titles for it, medicine, and still be a licensed registered nurse in the U.S. And I found out that's really not the case. That's really not how it is.
So how did you find that out?
So I went to Mary Hardin Baylor, had an excellent education there. Love UMHB. And while I was there, I did get a very solid understanding of how the body works.
Yes, yes.
And how our bodies help us heal and help us just live our daily lives, and understood anatomy, physiology.
So you got real science.
Science, yes, actual science. But then whenever I started practicing in the hospital setting as an RN, I realized this was not, we were not using the body to heal. We were using our own mechanisms through medicine to try and force the body to cope, not even heal, but just cope with its disease.
Yeah. So when did you graduate from nursing school?
In 2020.
Whoa!
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So you went into it.
Yes.
So, okay, so your first job was in a hospital.
Yes, it was in an ICU. So I received the job offer in February of 2020, back when the world was different. Yeah. And so it's going to be a general ICU. I was going to get to see hearts and lungs and kidneys and all the cool ICU things. And by the time I began in June of 2020, it was a completely different unit. It was mostly COVID. And that is where I got my start.
Were there a lot of people in the hospital with COVID?
Yes, there were.
So the units were filled.
We were full, and it was it fluctuated. It was very interesting because we were a 30-bed ICU, and we would go from just 10 beds being COVID ICU for the whole city.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we were the only hospital accepting COVID patients.
Okay, so wait a minute. 10.
Right.
For the city of Waco.
Mm-hmm.
That's not very many.
It's really, yes. But it would fluctuate. Yes.
Yes.
And so it would be 10, and then we would look up and it would be the whole unit of 30, and we would overflow.
Right. Right.
And it was a disaster.
So what would happen? they were truly sick because they were in the ICU.
Right.
Was there just a non-ICU COVID ward that
yes,
they would
go
to?
Yes, there was as well. Yes, there okay. was the like med surge level, lower right. level, just needing oxygen or comfort measures. And then there was our level, which was something called BiPAP, which is a mask that forces air in and forces air out, and it's a high level of oxygen. And then there's the ventilated patients.
Okay, so if they got to needing kind of a pressurized respiratory, you know, more assistance breathing,
right.
they were admitted to the ICU.
Correct.
Okay, and so you were at the front lines of that respirator issue. Did you have any respirator shortages?
We did have issues where we were trying to find more ventilators from other facilities.
Wow.
We had to learn as nurses how to use different machines in the moment. At one point, we had about three different kinds of ventilators on the unit. And each ventilator, you have to know the settings, you have to know, I mean, there's so much going on. It's not just
yeah.
a machine pushing air in. There's all these different settings. So one of your patients would have one ventilator, and then you'd go to the next room, and it would be a totally different
wow.
ventilator, and you're having to learn. And thankfully, we had excellent respiratory therapists who were there to help. But
yeah.
in the moment, you're having to just figure that out because
right.
we were running out of ventilators.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. So were they on the respirator when they came in, or were they just sick? Who made that decision to put the patient on the respirator? Because I know, you know, in the history of medicine,
mm-hmm.
you know, the patient that would go on a respirator really never had a choice. It wasn't like, okay, is it time to put you on the respirator? And the patient says, no, I think I'm okay. Let me have a little break here for a while. You know, I'll let you know when I'm ready. No,
right.
that was not the case. So there was... there was a very odd situation where the patient was coherent, that they had good oxygenation,
mm-hmm.
And yet the medical profession is telling them to go on a ventilator.
Right.
So what was that like?
So what I experienced was when I first began in June of 2020, they had already been fighting this virus for several months.
Right.
But at this point, it was still relatively very early in the fight against it. We were waiting until the patient was in extreme distress breathing before
okay.
we put them on a ventilator. A lot of times it was emergent. And maybe the patient was incoherent at that point because they were not able
so
to
oxygenate. So it was an appropriate use of the ventilator.
It was,
so,
in theory. So as we went along, people were getting on the ventilators and they weren't coming off. I mean, it was almost a death sentence to be put on it.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
This is Matt asking a question here. When I had COVID, I was taking a deep breath. My lungs filled with air, but I wasn't getting any oxygen. I couldn't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard this before. Correct me if I'm going off the wrong end here. But using a ventilator on somebody to fill their lung with air when they have COVID, what good is it if the lung isn't receiving the oxygen? You're just mechanically functioning. Am I correct or did I miss something?
I think that's a fair question to ask. If there is, though, with a ventilator, it has different types of pressures that it allows. So I think that's the benefit of the theoretical benefit of a ventilator is there's like end pressure and there's different things. So whenever you end your breath, the ventilator is able to give you just a little bit more to open your alveoli. To supposedly help you oxygenate more. And we would see improvement in the number, the oxygen number on the screen. But I see what you're saying. It's the machine is a little bit smarter. Not smarter. I don't want to say smarter. It's a little bit more forceful than just you breathing in. It's pushing that air in, whereas when you and I breathe, our diaphragm lowers and it pulls our lungs open, whereas the ventilator is like pushing
positive
air.
Positive pressure. Yeah. So,
which there's debate on if that positive pressure is actually good for us because we weren't
exactly.
created for that.
That's right. And so you know, if it were really, really good, the survivability would be a lot mm-hmm. higher, right? Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't, it, you know, I mean, right. So you're saying it was a death sentence, and it wasn't a supportive measure, it was just keeping them alive for a period of time. But
right.
All of the other things that they could have been doing, like ivermectin or hydroxy or any of those things they could have been doing, you remember, Matt, we used the hydroxychloroquine nebulizers yes. that Zelensky and I worked on, and it was very interesting. But
well, you know, you gave me that.
I gave you those. Yeah, then we ran out. We couldn't find a pharmacy in the state of Texas to make them. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was just no one was making them. And then Dr. Zelensky passed. You know, so it was that was a real you know, difficult time trying to figure out who am I going to save these hydroxychloroquine nebulizers. I started giving them. I'd give 5, 6, 7 to a person, and then you know, by the end of it, we were just, you know, giving 1 or 2 doses to people because we just couldn't. There were too many people. So, was there any perception on the part of the medical staff that you were worried about catching COVID from these people?
Oh, absolutely. It was kind of a constant fear of getting COVID, because I think, and I'm sure you remember, a big part of the propaganda of COVID is, well, yeah, the survivability is good for you, but you may kill your grandmother. You know, you may get it and you're going to give it to your grandma, and grandma's going to die because grandma's has all these comorbidities. So we weren't, when I say we as in like the American people, we weren't able to see the evidence and say, well, it's a 97% survivability. I can feel okay about it. They
right.
say, oh, no, well, your grandma's in the 3%. So you can't get it from work, you can't get it. And so there was a lot.
So they were scaring you that, like, you can't get COVID at work because you could kill grandma.
Yes, that's how I took it. It was very,
Look, I mean, if you're going to get it, you know, you were around people mm-hmm. 24 hours a day, and you were around people that had COVID. I mean, you're right. going to get it, right? I mean, there's no other way mm-hmm. to look at it, is you're going to be exposed to it. And did you have any symptoms of COVID? Did you contract COVID?
I never, I never got it. There was one day there were several times I think we all have had where we thought, oh my goodness, do my lungs feel okay? I might have
right,
it.
Right.
But I never had COVID. I never got it.
Well, but that was your COVID, mm-hmm. Aslan. Your COVID was one day.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what it was. I mean, that... And, you know, that Stanford study that I always have talked about, you know, that people were asymptomatic. They really didn't even know they had it. Or, you know, they had a bad headache for one day. Or, you know, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, they had some kind of weird taste in their mouth. Or maybe, you know, things didn't taste quite as good as normal. And then it was done, you know.
Yeah.
So the vast majority of young people under the age of 25 did great. You know, the survivability was really, really high. So it was irrational for a goal to not get COVID. Like, how do you not get COVID? Mm-hmm. You're bathing this person. You're helping them get up. You're combing
right.
their hair. Like, right? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
And I do think it cut down on the nurse's desire to go in the room to care for their patient, because we were so afraid of getting it ourselves and giving it to our child with asthma or our grandma or whoever, that we did see, I saw a major decrease in quality of care, because we were spending less time in the room and we had to gown and do all the things to go in. And so there is certainly a decrease of care and fear of spending more time around it and contracting it.
So they put you in these, like, biohazard suits, you know, mm-hmm. pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And did Were you told, or was the perception that, okay, this is going to protect you?
That was the original perception. We were all given respirators, and we were all given the highest quality gowns and gloves. And even at the beginning, we had medical techs and people who would be outside the room, and we would walk outside the room, and they would degown us and take everything off, and we would clean everything. And but as it went on, we started losing supplies and people because right. everyone was using so many supplies.
Sure.
So we started reusing these masks that should have been one-time use. We were okay. using them like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
2 weeks for reusable masks that should go away. So it was
so
very
hard. So how did you feel? I mean, here you are. You go from an excellent education in nursing, and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm now I've got the science behind me, I'm ready to help, I'm ready to jump in, and the biggest crisis in our country hits, and you're there, you're on the front lines, and now they're saying, okay, well, you know, just, we don't have the money, or, you know, just use this mask again.
Yes.
And did you worry that, you know, this increased your risk for infection, or?
Well, by the time that took place, where I was starting to use some low-level protection, at that point, the veil had been starting to lift for me on the actual danger that I was in. So for me, I wasn't quite as worried about that mask or that low level of protection, because I was starting to see this isn't what we're told it is. Like, this is not
right.
The big monster of a virus that we're all supposed to be afraid of. So it didn't bother me quite as much not using a respirator or reusing gowns, because at that point I was pretty convinced that it wasn't as scary as we thought.
Yeah. And, you know, in spite, and here you go again, having the ability to have discernment and wisdom in the face of, you're in an ICU and you're going, oh, this virus isn't as bad as I thought it was. You know?
I wanted to add to that, because you just touched what I was thinking. Did you come up, you came across, or you came upon this realization by your own seeing, or were you around people who were longer in the medical field who gave you an impression, and then you started thinking, of, was it so blatantly obvious that you made it yourself being first time into this?
So, good question. I think a lot of it was Holy Spirit just revealing what was behind all of this. I think a lot of the nurses and physicians I had come to admire in the ICU thought the opposite for me. They were very, I don't want to say afraid, but very convinced that it was a dangerous disease and it was something we needed to be afraid of. And so I started, doing my own research and using that skepticism that I was trained and raised to have. And I just started looking around. You kind of have to take a step back. I think we all need to do that. Take a step back, get off social media, get off all those things that are just yelling at you all the time to think this way. Taking a step back and saying, okay, let's look at the big picture here. Let's look at who's getting sick. Let's look at, I am able to make my own decisions. I think that's another thing where our generation is taught, this is how you think, because this is what Instagram has said, this is what Twitter has said, this is what everyone thinks right now. So if you don't think it, you're missing out.
That is why people like, look, we have a connection here. We have a common thread, us three, and everybody who watches us and those we associate with. The common thread is we're self-thinkers, we have common sense, we can figure it out, we check it out, as compared to being sheep led to slaughter. I congratulate you.
Yes.
Absolutely. And think about how young, you know, she is. And And gosh, I wish I could talk to your parents so that I could follow and sell, you know, what they, you know, they're amazing people to have given you this independent thought. And, you know, my feeling was I didn't want to, you know, just cram information in my child. I wanted them to, you know, think about something and that God would open up opportunity, and he did with you, you know, for you to step out and make a decision and have the discernment that you needed to be able to see in the face of the doc that you respect and trust and all of these nurses that are highly trained. I mean, they've been through it, and so you're sitting there saying this virus is not like what they're advertising.
Right, right.
And wow.
On the unit, people were dying, and it was really scary. And so that is, I think, where myself and my peers were looking at the same evidence. We were both seeing the same patient laying in the bed dying. They saw it as COVID did this, but I saw it as we did this. We are the ones causing this from our poor treatment of this virus.
Wow.
And that is where kind of the split became. I started feeling that separation between me and my peers was just what we were really looking at, what this was. Because I think you can use the fact that we were overflowing with COVID patients and we were in PACU and we had just curtains in between patients and they were ventilated, but there was just a curtain in between them and the next patient. Right. It was like an army hospital. It was crazy. You can see that, and you can see that as evidence of why you need the vax and why you need to be afraid. Or you can see that as, what are we doing here that's causing these patients to get this sick? Like, what are we not doing and what are we doing that is letting this virus just ransack their bodies? And so that is why I think we're at such a stalemate in our country of, like, we're seeing the same information, but we're interpreting it differently.
Before we go at the bottom of the hour, I want to come back. I want to find out about, like, how did they treat it, and what did the patients ask for? But were there any other nurses that you were working with that were like-minded? I mean, you can kind of feel those people out as you're working in the staff and everything. I mean, did you see people that were like-minded to you, or was it just this, I just don't get this, everyone around me is...
Yes. We were there. I believe there were some people, some nurses who also were kind of going, oh, I don't know about this.
Right.
But I would say the environment was so angry and comply or die socially that I really just stayed quiet about it. You're so exhausted. I mean, it was exhausting that I personally didn't have the margin to be able to talk to anyone about what I was thinking, because it was just so overwhelming. The thought of this thing that I've wanted to be my whole life, this excellent nurse who cares and loves people, this ideal that I have sold myself to isn't what I thought it was. It's, we're not taking care of people. That is exhausting.
But you know, Aslan, and my philosophy on this is, we need good people. We need good people now more than we ever have. And so I want to finish the story. When we get back, we're going to ask Aslan all the insider questions of what it was like to be in the ICU during the pandemic. And she is so brave and courageous to talk with us. Thank you. So we'll be back.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, be back in about 4 minutes. Welcome back, everybody, to the Aaron's High Cap Adventure Radio Program, the Facebook Live edition. Special guest, Dr. Shelley Cole. It's always a pleasure, Shelby.
With our extra special guest.
Well, I was going to let you do the intro. This will be our final segment. So.
Right. So, we are talking to Aslan Murphy, who is a nurse practitioner student, and she's telling us what it was like to be a student, to dedicate your life to a profession that you believed in. You know, I remember myself, and I'm just going to diverge for a second, but I remember I was probably 8 to 10 years of age, and I was walking on my driveway when I was a little girl, and I remember saying, someday, I think it was the Holy Spirit, someday medicine's going to be socialized. Now, I didn't articulate that word in my brain because I didn't know what it was, but I said, someday medicine's going to be socialized, and that's not good, but I still want to be a part. I still want to be a part. And so the mindset of we need good people, you know, we need people that are going to be willing to stand up, you know, articulate their position, fight for that patient. You know, we need those people. We need them now more than we ever have. And so I want to keep understanding the story, you know. And so there was a fear of getting COVID by the staff. And so how did that change? You said that they didn't go in the room as much, or?
So that fear, I think, it changed. It really never left. We were always afraid. And I think that led to bitterness. We were really were so exhausted from the constant fear.
Right.
That we started getting really cold towards our patients, because you would leave work and you'd go home and it was all over the news, it was all over everything, your spouse was talking about it, your kids were talking about it, I think that fear started growing like a cancer in us, that we were just starting to we lost the drive of nursing, in that we saw these patients as just, I hate to say it, but we almost knew they were going to die. And so there was just kind of a wall between you and the patient because you didn't really want to get attached. I think that is a strength of nursing, is that we do get attached to our patients and we love them and care for them and hear about their lives. But so many of them were ventilated, and so we couldn't learn about them.
You can't talk to a ventilated patient. Right. They're paralyzed.
Right. Yes. Right. They're out. And so, we started, and then it was also a coping mechanism for myself to distance myself from them in a way.
Right.
Because
right.
if I saw my dad in that bed, or I could see my grandmother in that bed, it was too much. And so I would find reasons to separate myself from them, or why I'm not like them.
Right,
And I found out later, you know, that's like a coping mechanism. But
it is. That's right.
And so I guess to answer your question about just that fear, it morphed and it changed. I think it changed us as people and as nurses.
And so that must have been extremely discouraging, especially... Mm-hmm. You know, you're bright-eyed, you're passionate, you're just getting out of training, you know, and then to be thrown into it, and to see the harsh reality that, no, it's kind of us against them.
Right.
Is that how it felt? That, you know, it was, the patients were there, they were really sick, we shouldn't get that. And I'll just say, you know, the previous generations in medicine, we never once thought about the consequence of contracting an infection or anything. That was just part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this mindset, and I don't think that you got it as much, because I'm really happy to hear that people were appropriately put on the ventilator and not just rash to prevent spread of the virus, you know, for more conservative measures like a nasal cannula or the BPAP, those kind of things where the virus can, you know, literally spread more. But some people have testified that they really did have this mindset of, we are putting them on the ventilator earlier because we don't want to contract the infection ourselves. We want to minimize the exposure in the environment, mm-hmm. so we're putting them on the ventilator.
Yes, yeah. And we did, as it progressed, we did start ventilating earlier. I do believe it was with good intentions. Mm-hmm. Our intention was, let's go ahead and sedate and ventilate now before the lungs become so fibrotic that the ventilator won't work. And so we would ask the patient, who was breathing fairly normally, I mean, they needed a high level of
oxygen
yeah. at that point, so they weren't just hanging out. But
right.
They did need a high level of oxygen, and we would ask them, come in, do you want to be intubated now? And that was a horrible part of my job, because yeah. I kind of knew.
And what if they said no?
If they said no, we would allow that. I mean, I do appreciate how our hospital handled it. We weren't, like you were saying, there are stories of people kind of being forced into it too, because when you're on a ventilator, it's a closed system. Your
right.
breath is going into the machine and through the machine. And so, it does, in theory, protect the people around you more, because you're
right.
not just breathing out the particles and the germs.
Right,
But I can say with confidence that at least was not advertised at my hospital, that we were attempting to just keep them in a closed
That's
system.
That's good. That's so. Good. Did any patients ask for, did they use ivermectin in the hospital at all?
No, we didn't use
okay.
it in the hospital. Patients would ask about it. Of course, we didn't make it a big stink about it, but
right.
we definitely did not honor.
So, like, if somebody said, hey, instead of putting me on the ventilator, I want to use ivermectin, what would you say?
Well, at that point, it really, in theory, would be too late if you're so sick that you need the ventilator. I still think that maybe that would be true. I don't know, but that was usually our response is, well, it's too late for, they would say, you're a horse dewormer, you know, try to make
So they it called out. It a horse dewormer?
Oh, well, the nurses would. We would definitely, we as in just the whole, not myself,
right.
but had very strong opinions about the dewormer and all these different attempts, and if a patient had come in and they had tried ivermectin and they were in the hospital, that just fueled the flame against it.
So would they kind of label that patient, and they used ivermectin?
Yes, it was always talked about.
They're one of those.
I would get report on my patient for that shift, and if they had taken ivermectin at home, I can guarantee you that nurse was going to tell me and report, they tried ivermectin at home. And
so it was that, so now knowing you, did you kind of think, oh, well, good. Maybe they're going to be better off now that they have some ivermectin on board.
Yes, it did. I had to be quiet about it because I couldn't really say my opinions, but
unbelievable.
Deep down, I was like, okay, good for you. Like, you tried.
Wow.
You tried. But at the same time, it felt discouraging because I thought, okay, they tried that
and
here they are.
Right.
So
right.
There's that conflict in me of, okay, well, what do I think about that? And then, but the dosing and the timing all have a part to play in that, and so I have to remember that.
Yeah, so, I mean, we took care of about 4,000 patients out of the hospital. I mean, that was mm-hmm. my goal, to keep them out
That's
of the
amazing.
Hospital. And so we used ivermectin to prevent COVID, but also mm-hmm. to treat early COVID.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had... And we still have patients calling, but what I called early treatment, because instead of, you know, having some symptoms, calling up a doc, finding a doc who would write ivermectin, finding a pharmacist that would fill it,
mm-hmm.
that would sometimes take weeks and weeks, and by the time, you know, they're over their illness, and or it's protracted in a COVID long haulers, but we would actually have a script for them at home, and then we'd say, look, you have two symptoms. You either have a bad, bad headache or you have loss of taste or smell. Then you start your meds. And so that was, and I would have loved to have studied it, but we were so busy in the trenches, we didn't have time to do anything. But I will tell you, human ivermectin, the prescription ivermectin, was extremely successful. It was very effective and continues to be in patients with COVID long haulers or a vaccine injured. You know, so did you see a change in, so like, well, what did you all use to treat people in the ICU? You didn't just give them supportive care and, or what did you do?
Well, we kind of just did in a way, other than, remdesivir. We tried the antiviral IV.
Right.
And it was, I couldn't figure out a pattern while I was there of who got it and why. It seemed, to me, to be kind of random when we would decide when to use it and when to initiate it.
Wow.
I think the thought process was when it was contracted, it only had a window of usefulness. And so I, on my shift, I would give some patients remdesivir IV and some patients not, and really in the middle of it, I really couldn't figure out why some people did and some people didn't.
Interesting. Well, you know, they got a 20% kickback on the hospital bill, not just on the entire hospital, but if you use remdesivir during hospitalization, they got an additional 20% on top of it.
Yeah.
This EUA, this drug that's never been approved by the FDA, and yet, oh, we can't use ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, which are FDA approved drugs.
Right.
You know, that made no sense whatsoever. So did you, so there wasn't a rational, okay, this person's at this level, now we're going to give them remdesivir. It was kind of hit and miss.
That's how I perceived it. It seemed to be just kind of chaos and try what we can for certain people, and I couldn't really tell. I would just hang it when they told me to hang it, and I did start looking into it in the middle of all of that, trying to figure out what is this drug.
Wow.
And it was extremely discouraging because I found that it was only tested on about 50 people before it became just what we used as standard of care.
At least they're consistent.
Yeah, at least they're consistently sketchy.
Science.
Yes.
So, yes, it had been approved for use in other circumstances, and I think it was Ebola, and the death rate was so high from it after 30 days that they decided to cut the usage down to 10 days. That's, you could only use it for 10 days because the death rate wouldn't be quite as bad.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, how ridiculous is this? You know? So did you see any side effects to it? Did you say, gosh, you know, these people are sicker, or hey, they are getting better because of remdesivir?
I can say I never saw a marked difference in getting better with it. It just seemed to just go in and we'll cross our fingers and hope you don't end up on the ventilator kind. I mean, that's kind of the underlay of it. And this is another example of seeing the same evidence but drawing different conclusions because so many of our COVID patients ended up on dialysis. They were not dialysis patients before, but they ended up on dialysis. And so we were looking at that evidence and saying, oh, COVID is so bad. It kills your kidneys and you need dialysis. But then you can also look at it and say, well, maybe our remdesivir that we just gave them hurt their kidneys. Maybe there's other medication we're giving that's causing this to happen. So it's just that questioning that...
Right. Was it COVID that caused the kidney failure, or was it the treatment, remdesivir, that caused the kidney failure? And, and so, again, from the perspective of outpatient care of COVID patients, which I took care of, We didn't have one incident of COVID causing kidney failure. Right. Where a patient needed to be put on a dialysis unit because of COVID.
Right.
Not one case.
Mm-hmm. So that makes you question.
So that, you know, then you start to question it. Like, mm-hmm. So now they're, you know, and you could see this horrible trend. You know, they go on the remdesivir, and now they're in the ICU, and now they have to be dialyzed. You know, mm-hmm. It's unimaginable. Mm-hmm. And then they die.
Right.
Shelley, I got a question for you. When this was starting out, would you have naturally said, well, let me try ivermectin? Is it that obvious that it could be applied to this COVID problem?
So the first drug that I used was hydroxychloroquine. There was no discussion about ivermectin at that time. And that was March of 2020. And I do remember reading James Todaro's work on prevention and treatment of patients in the hospital in China and South Korea. So I started with hydroxy. And it was extremely cheap. For a therapeutic dose of hydroxychloroquine, it was $12.17. And, you know, they would do great. They did great, you know. We had one death out of the 4,000 roughly that we took care of. And that was because they couldn't actually get their meds, you know. So I'm going to say May, maybe June of 2020. That's when I first started writing ivermectin. And it had a little bit greater benefit. And so, you know, somebody who was really, really sick, and it was cheap. It was very cheap at that time, which was interesting. You could get it for roughly the same price as hydroxychloroquine. But then, of course, it became politicized, and, you know, then it became, you know, high demand, and so the price went up, and so now, you know, it's not uncommon for a dosing of one day to be $30 or $40, you know, for ivermectin. So if you had a 10-day course, you know, that's $300 or $400 for ivermectin. It's still a lot cheaper than an ICU bed, you know, but it really was more... It was more the slight advantages of ivermectin. And so now we know that there are about 40 mechanisms of action, the way ivermectin works. And I know people, I've heard some people say, well, they overinflate the benefit of ivermectin. I have never been disappointed with ivermectin. I will say that sometimes people require a higher dose. You know, we may need to bump up the therapeutic range, which is perfectly safe. The normal doses that we use around 400 micrograms per kilo may not benefit, so we can safely go to 600. And there are reports that say using ivermectin at 10 times the normal recommended dose is still very, very safe. So we could go up higher if we needed to, but I've never been disappointed by it. Never had a kidney failure with it, and never had a death with it. So it's devastating, and so man, there's so much I could ask, you know. But you've been so honest about it, and I appreciate you know telling us again, just courage. And maybe you, I'm sure it was very wearing. Not being able to speak out, and when you had gone on rotations before the pandemic, while you were in nursing school, was debate encouraged? Was discussion of management of disease encouraged? You know, I mean, or was it just nope? I'm sorry, it's black and white, and this is what we do for this, and you know, you got to do it this way.
I believe that. It wasn't as pronounced as it became in COVID.
Right.
But I do think it's been decades of our way or the highway. in nursing at least. But we maybe didn't notice as much because we didn't have a pandemic in our faces. But I think that the issue of the system, it bowed to the system, this is what you do, has been in our culture for decades.
Yeah.
But maybe we just didn't notice as much because we were just quietly managing our chronic illnesses and kind of just living our lives. And so rocking the boat wasn't really, didn't seem all that necessary.
Right.
And so I don't think COVID brought anything new. I think it just exacerbated what was already there.
Just exposed them. And they became so arrogant.
Yes.
You know, that it was just, it now it's just so in your face. And so, like, you know, an astute nurse that goes, man, it just seems like every time we put this guy on remdesivir, then now we got a kidney failure. What the heck is going on? You know?
Right.
You know, they would have had a grand rounds about that, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, let's figure out what's going on. You know, but I will say, you know, even 40 years ago when I was in med school, the mindset, and I used to roll my eyes and I would get discouraged by independent thinkers like Aslan, you know, it's like, oh gosh, here he goes again. He's interrupting. Oh no, I'm going to have to listen to this guy. But there were a couple of them in my class, and so now I totally admire them, you know, because I was one of those go along, get along, just be quiet, just listen to the material. But I trusted mm-hmm. what I was learning because it was scientific, you know.
Yes.
Little did I know that, you know, my profession had been usurped all
this time. Aslan, say something though, because I say prayers, I say prayer to the Lord about patients, that they heal quickly. And that the doctors take the wisdom from him to do the proper healing. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with science. God gave you science. But
absolutely.
You got discernment. You pray discernment. I'm impressed.
Yeah. Matt's trying to find find someone for him to marry. We're like, how do I keep her around here?
I don't want to embarrass her. I'll tell you what, though, since you brought it up, this is a catch, you guys.
Totally. Are you kidding me? Unbelievable. Beautiful and intelligent.
Thank you. Guys are like, oh, my God.
That's right. You're an idiot if you don't say that. You know, so, but thank you so much, Aslan. That was so much fun. And giving us a real perception into what it was like to be... a young, passionate nurse. So now you went back to school.
Yes, I'm back in school.
In spite of all that, you said, I'm going in for more.
Yeah, more of that.
So now what are you doing?
So now I'm in nurse practitioner school purely so I can get the certification and respect, I suppose, of the system to be able to do really what you're doing and being kind of your own thing out
being
here.
Being a practitioner.
Yes.
Being a practitioner.
Truly caring for people, healing people, not just managing and telling people to cope, but actually giving them the tools to have a life that is full and healthy and not just slowly die. And I mean, just it's live until you die. And that's what I want to be able to do. And I think I need that NP behind my name to be able to do that. So that's what I'm hoping to do.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
And we'll be back.
All right. Ladies, fantastic job. Everybody else out there, we'll be back. Stay tuned. And don't forget, you can review this whole Facebook interview. Just go to aaronsgunshop.com. See you. Until then, God bless. Keep your powder dry.